With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, Bev Thomas on her debut novel, A Good Enough Mother.
Bev Thomas was a clinical psychologist in the NHS for many years. She currently works as an organisational consultant in mental health and other services. And Bev's debut novel, which we're going to talk about today, is A Good Enough Mother. Bev, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much for having me. Lovely to be here.
So how would you describe the novel?
I did work, as you say, in the field for quite some years. So in a way, I'd been reluctant, I think, to set a book in that world. But I think it's probably that old saying, write about what you know, and it seemed to kind of work for me. So the world is very authentic, but it is about a trauma therapist, a psychotherapist, who is fantastic at her job. Ruth Hartland, she is the top of her game. She's the director of a unit. And she's excellent clinically. Unfortunately, her personal life tells a different story in that she has twins, boy and girl, and the 17-year-old boy, Tom, is missing. So she's a woman in grief. She's a mother who's grieving. She doesn't know where her son is. And she's continuing to work. He disappeared 18 months ago. And the story really kicks off when she sees a new referral. She goes to the waiting room to collect a new referral. And as she looks down the corridor and sees the person, she thinks for one beautiful but then terrible moment that it's her son. And really, it isn't him. And then it kind of rolls out from there and things start to unravel for her.
So tell us about Ruth's clinic. There's a particular method that they're using to,
yes,
you know, to counsel people. Tell us what they're doing.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's lots of different types of therapy, and this particular type of therapy is drawn from the psychoanalytic tradition. So the particular feature of that, there's a number of them, but one of the particular ones that is drawn out in the book is the concept and the notion of the transference. So that involves, there's something very significant that goes on between the patient or client and the therapist. And it's a space really where the client can project feelings that they may have that perhaps are drawn from previous relationships onto that therapist. Now, that involves the therapist being what's called a sort of blank slate, really, and not really bringing themselves into the room. And of course, what goes wrong for my character, Ruth, is that, of course, she's bringing a lot into the room, because as soon as she thinks that this new person looks so like her son, things get very muddled for her. So personal and professional boundaries aren't able to, they just get very blurred. So, with that type of therapy, it is really, I suppose that's one of the kind of fundamentals of it, is that it is looking at the relationship, but it's also looking at sort of what isn't said. So it's looking at the kind of unconscious things rather than something that's very, very surface in front of you. So it's a particular methodology. And I was very interested, I suppose one of the things that I was very keen on in writing this is that I think very often psychology or therapy is used in fiction as kind of more plot points or plot driven. I was very interested in exploring the actual methodology in the book, so that the therapy is the story, as opposed to it being a kind of add-on or a plot device, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I want to discuss that in a bit more detail in a minute. But first of all, just staying with some of the psychological ideas, the title itself,
yes,
of the novel. So A Good Enough Mother, you know, refers on the surface to Ruth and, you know, the plot of the story about, yeah, around her, you know, family troubles. But the Good Enough Mother is also an idea, a psychological idea from a fellow called Donald Winnicott. So what is it?
So Winnicott talked about, I mean, it was a sort of groundbreaking idea, really, because I suppose what he was saying is that to be a good enough mother, it means that you have to allow your child to experience small, manageable frustrations in life. So that obviously while your child's a very small baby, you do need to attend to the child absolutely instantly because they're small and defenseless and tiny. But as they get older, they need to manage small amounts of frustrations in order that they are able to cope with the frustrations of life. So life is light and dark. It's full of joy and frustration. And his concept was that the good enough mother or the good enough parent enables a child through their childhood and upbringing to experience that so that they are equipped better to go through life into adulthood. And I guess what I was trying to explore with the character of Ruth in this book is that because of her own issues, which are obviously touched on too in the book, her own childhood and her own difficulties and background, is that she struggles to allow her son to be who he is. I'm probably not alone in saying this, is most parents at one time or another would say that it's incredibly challenging to see your child distressed or unhappy. But the kind of Winnicottian idea would be that you would bear that and allow them to experience those feelings and not rush to take them away or deny them. And I guess what's going on for Ruth is because she struggles so much with that, is that she can't bear it in her son, Tom. Tom is kind of, he's sort of on the edge a little bit of society. He's not a great socialiser. He's a particular type of character who doesn't easily fit into groups. And he's very distinct from his twin sister, Carolyn. And so I suppose, in a way, the kind of twinship, as it were, highlights their differences even more. And I guess what Ruth finds unbearable is the fact that he does struggle, that he does find it difficult to fit in and be sociable and find his way in a friendship group. And the fact that it becomes unbearable to her means that she kind of gets him to sort of do and fit in with things that really aren't him. And the difficulty with that, of course, is that she is ultimately kind of not really seeing who he is, not really seeing Tom with all his sort of gorgeousness and loveliness of who he is, really. So she's trying to sort of make him something he's not. And I think that is a constant tension that's sort of weaved through the book, because obviously there's a dual narrative. There's the kind of present when she's in her clinic seeing the new client, Dan. But we also have moves back and forth between the twins' early life and growing up and trying to understand why, where he is, what's happened to him.
Tell us a bit more about, as you said, structuring the plot of the novel around the therapy. You've described it elsewhere as the novel is a psychological drama, you know, rather than a straightforward thriller.
Yeah, I mean, I was very, I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I find, you know, some of the good sort of question and answer in detective books can be very psychological. Mm-hmm. And the kind of drama that unfolds from that. I mean, my experience of working in the room with people when I used to work as a clinician is that it is really, it can be very dramatic. It can be also full of drama, full of conflict, full of high emotions. It can also be very boring. You know, I think there's a whole kind of range of emotion depending on what your client might be bringing in the room. But I was very interested in really, really focusing closely in on that interplay between therapist and client, because I think that there's something quite gripping, I think, about what can go on in the room. And yes, I absolutely. I mean, I think it's a psychological drama and a and a very bad thing happens, as opposed to a kind of plot-driven thriller. I mean, I had a very clear sense of what was going to happen, but all of the events are rolled out through the psychology of the characters. I mean, it felt very important to me that the characters made absolute psychological sense. And partly, obviously, that's drawn from what I used to do and what I still do in terms of my work, is that I was very sort of obsessed by that, you know, people have to kind of make sense in what they do. So the drama and the plot has kind of come from the characters as opposed to the other way around.
Well, let's talk about how you develop the characters in that way then. I was going to ask you about Dan. Tell us something about who Dan is, first of all, and then perhaps let's talk about, you know, including everybody, how you've built up the, you know, how you've chosen to build up the characters.
Well, Dan is a very tricky character. And I think, I mean, all of the characters and all of the clients in the book are entirely made up. They're all creations from my imagination. But I have to say, if I was seeing somebody like Dan, I would find him an incredibly tricky person to see. He's very complex. He finds it very difficult to trust people. And I think that as we learn I have to be careful not to give too much away, but there are some very difficult things in his own childhood, which do then emerge, which perhaps help us to understand where he's at and what he's going through. But I guess in some ways, you know, what I wanted to set up from the beginning is that we have a therapist who has a son who is missing. So she's kind of looking for a son. And we also have on the same day a new referral, a new client that turns up who is also, as it transpires, looking for a mother in some ways. So it's a kind of perfect storm, really, from page one. And while I think that the character Ruth knows, and she knows exactly what she would say to a colleague to do, she knows exactly that she should probably refer him on to somebody else, because of her own loss and void and grieving, it's something she doesn't do. She wants to see him too badly.
And the other thing to say is the novel is told from Ruth's perspective.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about that decision, because obviously what that means is, you know, this is Ruth's story and things, again, we're not going to talk about what happens, but, you know, things go wrong from a, you know, from a clinical perspective for Ruth. But of course, we're only hearing her perspective on it.
Yes, it's interesting. And I was very clear from the beginning. I didn't have a sort of, there was never a moment where I thought I wanted to hear other people. And I think in a way, I wanted to create something that was quite claustrophobic. And I think there is something that can go on in the room, which I think a couple of the scenes in the book, a number of chapters which are in the sort of therapy room, are also quite claustrophobic. There is a sort of a real focus between two people in a room sitting very close together. And I think that partly writing it from her perspective also means that she is also very caught in her head. So as a reader, we are also caught in her head. And I think that what I really wanted to do, and certainly the feedback I've had so far from people, seems to be that, you know, there are no easy answers. You know, I think there are lots of, I mean, I spoke to a woman who's currently practicing as a therapist now, and she said, I read parts of this and I thought, you know, I relate to this. I understand a line sometimes that one can cross. You know, I'm not talking about anything terrible that's happening, but occasionally seeing people that do resonate with you in a way that you can think, whoa, this doesn't feel quite right. So I think I wanted to create that. I deliberately wanted to create that feeling of claustrophobia in the book, on the page, so that in a way the reader is also caught up in Ruth's dilemma rather than being on the outside looking in, if that makes sense.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Bev Thomas, and we're talking about her debut novel, A Good Enough Mother. And Bev, you mentioned in the first half there that all of this is made up.
Yeah.
It's all of the characters are made up. But you have worked as a clinical psychologist for many years. And so obviously your experience in that work has gone into writing this book. So perhaps we could talk about how. And specifically, I want to talk about, I guess the ethics of writing about this sort of subject matter. How do you avoid writing about, you know, real instances, I guess?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think, so it's been a long time since I've worked as a clinician. I now work with staff teams who work in mental health and other services. So I'm kind of one step removed. But I think one of the things that I was also really passionate about when I started writing it is my experience of working with clinicians has been extraordinary. I feel that in some ways I wanted to write something that really celebrates the amazing work that people do. So while, again, without giving too much away, you know, things don't go well in Ruth's world, I think I also wanted to open a door into that world and show people, you know, what people are doing on a day-to-day basis. And I think that sometimes we can look at the front of a newspaper and read about terrible stories that have happened and not actually think about how they might be recovering their lives and carrying on. So, my experience has been phenomenal in terms of the clinicians that I've worked with. And so I'm full of admiration in a way for the way that people work. So I guess there's a part of me that also wanted to really celebrate that work. And particularly that model of therapy, because that's the one I've been trained in. So I suppose I've often read books or seen films, and it's the therapy aspect is quite generic. I was quite interested in really exploring this particular therapy in greater detail. So in terms of your question, I mean, I think that what's very real is my interpretation of a working department. I think there's a particular chapter in there that also talks about the stretched nature of the service and how difficult that is. And that is absolutely my experience now. I think mental health services are at crisis point. So I think there was also something I wanted to say in the book about there's a vulnerability of people. And at some level, and I don't think it is just about resources, I don't think we are meeting that need at the moment. So again, I can't say too much about that particular chapter, but my kind of ambition, I suppose, was to say some significant things about mental and psychological health and to talk about the work that people do. And the world is authentic. I mean, what I've tried to do through the characters is talk about things that happen. So while some of those experiences and examples are quite extreme, because obviously the focus is on a trauma unit, so people are coming in having experienced a traumatic thing, you know, they are things that happen. So I suppose in some ways I kind of think that it's very different if you're writing a kind of non-fiction book and you are doing case studies. That, I guess, is a whole other arena where you have to, I don't know, get permission or change the identity of people to such a degree that no one would be recognisable. I mean, I guess that, you know, that the clients in the book are, I think, really treated in a way that feels not just respectful, but I mean, just giving them giving people an opportunity to talk about some of these really difficult things that have happened, I think is also just a way of having that dialogue about it. You know, it isn't a particular type of person that ends up going to see a therapist. It could be anybody.
And I think I want to go over this again because, I mean, you've just mentioned it, but I think it's worth reiterating that, you know, the book does definitely cover the idea that, you know, no matter what a good job therapists are doing.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, Ruth in particular here is dealing with, you know, she's got this fractured home life as well, which is, you know, crossing over with her work. And in, you know, in some respects, obviously that's a good demonstration of how, you know, humanising the therapist,
yes.
You know, showing that.
Yeah.
But the point is that regardless of that, regardless of the good work that they're doing, more often than not, this service is inadequate for the patient's needs, really, isn't it?
In here or generally?
Well, in the real world.
Well, there's a sort of ongoing debate about it, isn't there, at the moment? And I think it's hard to pick up a newspaper at the moment and not see something about the difficulties with the services. So, yeah, I think there is a lot of, I think there are a lot of problems with resources and cuts, absolutely. But I also think that there is something that's probably required about thinking a bit more creatively about early intervention, particularly around adolescent and child mental health services, so that, you know, we're not picking up people at crisis point when they're in their kind of mid or late teens. My sense is that some of those young people could have been highlighted, identified earlier. So I think it is resources, but I think it is also something about how we're seeing our mental health services. I think there is something still incredibly split off from physical health, so it feels like this kind of two separate entities. And I think part of the journey and part of the work is to try and think about people in a more holistic way. But yeah, it is a constantly ongoing struggle. And as a result, I think that people in the services would be undoubtedly stretched. I don't think, I mean, it's a lovely thing to be able to say that if you can't see someone for some other reason, you would be able to pass on to a colleague. I wonder how easy that is in the current climate to do that.
We talked earlier about, you know, the book being character-driven and therapy-driven. I guess I want to talk about how the book came about in the first place. So,
sure.
At what point did you, you know, when did you decide you were going to write a novel, I guess?
Well, I have been writing for a long time, actually, and I think I had steered clear of writing anything to do with my work, so... You know, one of my books was in sort of, you know, 17th century Greece. Another book was somewhere else. You know, I think I sort of did everything I possibly could to avoid writing something I knew very well. And I think it was partly, going back to your question about ethics, I think partly I didn't want a client with mental health issues to be at the kind of core of the book. And it was only really when I sort of flipped the concept and thought I could make the protagonist a therapist who has her own Achilles heel that somehow the book started to sort of unroll for me, really. And I was very interested in exploring grief in some ways. And I suppose that's when I had that in my head and her as the protagonist, it kind of slotted together. Because obviously grief, not just bereavement, but grief is something that grief and loss finds its way very frequently into the consulting room. It could be bereavement, but it could be loss of identity or loss of job, relationship, loss of a family member through drugs or mental health. I mean, there's so many different forms of loss. So I was very conscious that was quite a powerful emotion, so that once I'd kind of put that together with the protagonist as a therapist, it sort of kind of, you know, rolled out in my head as a story quite quickly. So I think I probably do fit into that thing of the, you know, stick with what you know rather than go around the houses with other things.
Just a couple more things and I'll get you to read a bit of the novel, if you would. I want to talk about other writers that are an influence on you, but let's perhaps talk about, well, let's generally first of all, and then perhaps we can talk about this type of novel in particular.
Yeah. Oh, that's always a tricky one, isn't it? What have I just read? In fact, I have just read, which isn't a novel, but it is about trauma. I've just read something called the Trauma Cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you, I think it's
so for the Wellcome Prize. Yeah.
And that. So I'm very interested in psychological stuff, which is probably no surprise. And that doesn't have to be necessarily fiction. I do like a story, and I suppose the Trauma Cleaner is really interesting because it is about another person. So it's a biography of the trauma cleaner, but it's an extraordinary story. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's an extraordinary story. So that really struck me. But also, I think I'm very taken by stories where people have had these rather extraordinary lives and overcome or incorporated, perhaps not overcome is not necessarily the right word, but incorporated something very difficult and managed that in their life. So that's something that really stayed with me. I've just read that one recently. In fact, I was a bit late to the party on this one, but I've just read Grief is a Thing with Feathers, Max Porter, which I also like. You see, I'm obviously a trauma, grief. I'm obviously drawn to these themes. What else have I read? I would say that I read widely. I don't think I'm particularly drawn to... I don't have a kind of couple of favourite authors that I could sort of pull out and say I always read their books. But I do love kind of realistic psychology in fiction and non-fiction. So I think it's something about the kind of transformative journey of something that I'm really drawn to.
To finish off, can I get you to read us a bit?
Sure. Yes, I'd love to. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to read a piece from the very beginning. On paper, Dan Griffin was nothing out of the ordinary. He was anxious. He was urgent. He was like any other patient we see at the trauma unit. Unremarkable was how I described him to the police. When they looked for answers in those early therapy sessions, they read about the bruise on his face, the terror in his voice, and the flashbacks that were so visceral that they took his breath away. But there was nothing to hint at his capacity for violence, nothing at all to suggest what he was capable of. It took a while to understand that the question to ask wasn't, why didn't I see it coming? But why didn't I move out of the way? It's a Friday afternoon in April when I see Dan for his first appointment. It's the end of a difficult week, an onslaught of new referrals, an email about budget cuts, and then that morning, the unexpected phone call about the death of a patient, Alfie Burgess. The hospice nurse is kind as she tells me what happened. Peaceful, she said, and surrounded by family, then some other things I don't hear. You'll let the team know, is how she ends the call. Of course it should be me as head of department to tell them all, and in the past I'd happily rise to such leadership requests. It was something I was good at, competent, capable, and in control, spreading my arms wide to contain the distress of the department. But that day, in the run-up to Tom's birthday, my hand is shaking as I replace the receiver. It's a feeling that's been getting worse. The once fluttery sensation in the pit of my stomach has become a band of tension across my chest. It could be the death of anyone, a next-door neighbour's friend, or even the story in the news, but when it's someone I know well, like Alfie, it tightens until it becomes hard to move. There's never a picture or image that forms in my head, just a creeping sense of dread about Tom. I try to focus on Alfie, on how I will tell the team, but my body is rigid, like it's gone into hiding. Tom's birthday's become an obsession. I knew it would, it did last year. Lately, almost any event can serve as a marker of time. The first autumn leaves, the first dusting of frost, or the first smudge of purple and yellow crocuses, all small signs that the world is turning without him. But the day of his birth, his birthday, what mother doesn't want to transport herself back to the glorious cocoon of that moment, whatever the age of her child? There's a nervous kind of anticipation that I know will come to nothing. The date will come and go without him, the balloon of hope will deflate, and sometimes the sheer effort required to pump myself back into shape simply feels too much. I've had days like this before, and I know it will pass. However, for the moment, I am too full of it. If it was anyone else, any other member of my team, I'd tell them they shouldn't be at work. Go home, I'd say. Be kind to yourself. But for obvious reasons, home is the last place I want to be. That day, I am like an overfull bath. Drip, drip, drip. I feel heavy with the weight of it, as if one small request will send me sloshing and spilling out all over the floor. And yet still I hold up my hand for more. Another referral, an extra supervision group, a paper to present at a conference. Oh yes, I'll do it, I hear myself say, and I do it in the hope it'll fill the void. I'm not making excuses. There are no excuses. But my state of mind on the day I first meet Dan Griffin cannot be denied. Dan Griffin is my last patient that afternoon. My consulting room is around the corner from the waiting area, and the walk to collect a patient takes about a minute, a journey I've made hundreds of times over the last 25 years. Usually, as I walk to collect a new referral, I spend a few moments clearing my head, orientating myself to the new patient and the process about to begin. Today I don't. I'd like to say I was thinking about Alfie and his parents, but that would be a lie. I walk slowly and deliberately, my eyes on those swimming pool blue carpet tiles. It's just as I pass the stairwell that I look up and see him in the waiting room at the end of the corridor. I stop and stare. Everything else falls away. He's hunched in the chair by the door, head and hands, hair hanging down over his fingers. I hear myself make a noise, a muffled sort of cry, and then a wave rolls gently through me. I feel suddenly light, elevated. He's grown his hair long again. David would hate it, but I'm pleased. One of the last times I saw him, he'd hacked it off completely, leaving long golden curls in the bathroom sink that made me want to weep. Now it's grown back down to his shoulders. It suits him long, I think, as I reach a hand to the wall to steady myself. As I move closer, I can see his donkey jacket, the one we bought him for Christmas, the one with the tartan lining. My heart is thumping now. There's a new shirt, one I don't recognise, and a red rucksack on his lap. On his feet, Doc Martin boots, always those black boots. The sight of them makes me smile. Tom, here you are, is what I think, or perhaps I say out loud. My chest rises and falls, and I break into a clumsy run, startling the patients in the waiting room. Some look up. One of them is Tom. As he lifts his head, I feel a dull pain in my solar plexus, swift like a punch. It is not him.
So I've been talking to Bev Thomas, and we've been talking about her debut novel, A Good Enough Mother, which is out now in the UK from Faber. Bev, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.